This is Greg McDougall of EquitableEducation.ca from the World Forum on Free Media in Montreal. This interview with Anya Kovacs of the Internet Democracy Project in India was conducted Monday, August 8th, the day before the opening of the World Social Forum, bringing together over 10,000 people for the first time in a country in the global north.
My name is Anya Kovacs. I work with the Internet Democracy Project in India. We're based in Delhi. We work on a whole lot of issues to do with democracy, social justice, and the internet. And came to Canada now for the World Forum on Free Media specifically, though we'll be a little bit at the World Social Forum as well.
Yeah. I guess you're doing a presentation. I'm not sure if you're on your own or with your other people, but tomorrow on internet or on internet neutrality.
Yes. Well. I'm presenting on a panel tomorrow, which I was invited to come here for that reason. India had a very big fight regarding net neutrality and specifically on the issue of zero rating, which are basically small packages of specific websites which you can buy from a telco and or sometimes you can get for free, and which allows you access to only a little slice of the internet. And the question was whether that should be allowed in India or not.
And you were saying that's maybe like Facebook and other things like that?
Yeah, so there was one big package which was proposed by Facebook actually, and where Facebook collaborated with other websites. All those would be available for free.
But other websites wouldn't be, you couldn't get them.
No. Yeah. So if you would click on a link that would take you outside of the package, you would have to pay. And seeing the big inequalities that exist in India, the likelihood that people would stop exploring the internet as a whole as a consequence of these packages is quite big. There was also already research from some other countries where similar packages existed but only for Facebook, and where people actually thought of Facebook as the internet. So this includes Indonesia, where people were asked, do you use the internet? And they say no. And then they were asked, do you use Facebook? And they said yes. So the idea of what the internet really was wasn't even clear anymore to many people. So we had a very big battle on that topic in India. But the anti-zero rating people, which included us, won.
Okay.
It's a temporary victory because there will be a review in 2 years' time of that decision. But for now, the regulator wrote a very strong policy on that issue, which we thought was excellent.
It just, when I heard you say that, it seemed, like I was saying, our kind of net neutrality, what I'm aware of, is just the different speeds that at which sites would be available. So it would be kind of doing the same thing where there'd be like, I think you called it a walled garden.
Yeah.
There'd be kind of, and people would compare it, talk about like maybe an express highway versus local roads or whatever, that kind of for here. But it has the same effect where the certain websites become the ones that people use and the other ones don't have access. And you were talking about how I think maybe because of that or there is this a much higher consciousness about the role of capitalism in the internet and what it's doing in India and elsewhere than it is, say, over here in North America.
I think in general when you talk about rights issues, there is, if you use that particular language, I think there is a much stronger sense of how your ability to enjoy rights, or to exercise them, is always underpinned by political economy. And so it was interesting also to see, for example, a company like Google, which actually spoke, zero rating debates came up in the US as well. And they never became as big, but they were part of the net neutrality debate. And a company like Google took a very strong anti-zero rating stance in the US. In India, they were quiet on that debate. And it was Facebook that basically drove a lot of the discourse. In the end, they did so in a way that ended up hurting them. They made some big mistakes, and we benefited from that. But I think also the kind of investments that Facebook made, so in that whole process, as part of the mistakes they made, was they took out massive billboards all over India. They took up front advertisements, front pages of papers, all to kind of tell people, get onto this is a good thing and you should be in favor. They had messages for all the Facebook users in India and some outside India saying that the regulator is wanting to stop initiatives like what we want to do and so get people free access to the internet. You should write to them and protest now. The bad thing was that in a very, I mean, that was bad enough as it is, because how can a platform like Facebook really use their platform, which people have joined for other reasons, to do something like that? But what also happened was that there were people, there were stories came out of people who supposedly wrote to the regulator, but who had passed away. So they had a Facebook profile. Yeah. And somebody on their profile might just have clicked to see that notification from Facebook in more detail and automatically had a message had gone to the regulator. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of stories from people who said, I never wrote to the regulator, how can they do this? This became a massive thing. And then the regulator wrote a letter to Facebook and said, before the deadline, at the deadline of the submissions, the letter said, we have received more than a million emails by now, which come from people through your platform. But unfortunately, those emails do not address the questions in the consultation. So we cannot take these into account. Can you please write to all these people and tell them that we cannot take them into account, but that they are very welcome to answer the questions of the consultation, and we will extend the deadline with a week so that you have time to do that. And of course, Facebook never did that. And they were just angry with the regulator, but on the whole, he got a lot of support for doing what he did. I just think in that whole battle, the money power of Facebook was so obvious. Also, like, they took out these ads to say all the great things that zero rating does for people. And then there were people in those ads who actually had internet access before they used Facebook's package. And this also came out, was made public in the course of that campaign. So it was very clear that they were really trying to steer, using enormous amounts of money, a debate about a very sensitive issue in India, internet access, and how to make sure that everybody gets it in a country where a lot of people still live on very small incomes. And that they were misusing the sensitivity of that issue to try and get people to come to their side. So I think in instances like that, it's just, it becomes much easier to show to people how corporates underpin so much of our communication, how that affects how we can communicate, how that shapes the right to freedom of expression. Because in this case, many people would have started to think of the Facebook as the internet. And that would not, there might be an increase in freedom of expression, but if you really want to be able to communicate freely, you need to have at least some ownership, or at least a choice in what platforms you use to communicate, etc. And for them, the internet would not be open anymore as a choice as a whole. It would be the packages in the sites in those packages.
And when you said that, I just thought of, like, that's what we get, kind of like, if you're getting cable TV in North America, you're choosing your packages, but some obviously cost more and you can't afford them, and so.
But of course, the difference is that cable TV is, first, it's one-way traffic. You know, that's already a difference. So it's not taking away your voice in that sense. But also that you can't click through from one channel to the other. And this is the big thing about the internet. Even though people are right to say, like, we all spend 80% of our time on the same 10 sites. But if you ask me, if I think about it deeply, the bit about the internet that really empowers me is not the time I spend on Facebook and Twitter, though I do spend time on those platforms, but it's actually very often the other 20%. And I might find the things in that other 20% on Facebook or Twitter, but I have to be able to click that link to get to that content. And this is something that for those people, each and every time, we have supposedly then, we will say that all those people have access to the internet, but they actually only will have access to this really small piece of the internet and will not be able to consistently click through on all the links that might seem promising, but you only really know once you click on it, right? You can't always judge that beforehand.
There's a few issues. I mean, just the whole digital divide, I think. A lot in North America, we forget about it because it's just more and more people here have the internet, and we forget, I think, that a lot of people don't elsewhere. It was interesting what you were saying is that you were even questioning whether getting everyone on the internet is a good thing, because when you see where people are at, you're saying, like, aren't necessarily connected into the capitalist economy so much, but that's what the main thing the internet might do is if you're,
Well, it's kind of the way capitalism ties in with surveillance, be it corporate surveillance or state surveillance at this point in time. I think there is a lot of pressure in many developing countries, including India, still a lot of neoliberal pressure, and it does connect with technology as well, and it does connect with surveillance as well. The internet makes possible a lot of regimentation of people. In any case, India already now has a unique identification scheme, so they're trying to get the entire population to have a number. Even though that is not, you don't need the internet to get that number, but that system would not have been possible without the technology that is the internet. In that sense, like, already you see that everybody's lives in the country is being touched by the internet. And I mean, access numbers, we're still speaking about less than 20% of people who actually have regular internet access. Plus, literacy rates in India, they're a bit debatable, but some people say it's about 70-75% now. How good that literacy is a big question, but that also in any case means that there is at least 25% of the population that everybody agrees is not even literate. They are people who are never, like, unless they learn to read and write in their lifetime, they're not going to use the internet. They're already pulled into systems, and a lot the unique identification number is being sold to people in the name of providing development services. But it's also a way to keep very neatly tracked of where people go in a country where there is a lot of labor migration. The informal labor market is still massive. It's the biggest source of more than 90% of people work in the informal labor market, not in the formal labor market. So it's a way in which you can increasingly track people. And so that's a question, I think, to ask. We really need to make sure that the fundamental rights that are protected by the Indian constitution, and the constitution does protect them, India has a strong constitution, that we keep them alive and protect them even better in the digital age. Precisely because with the internet, with that technology, new forms of surveillance have come that give the state a much greater power than it has ever had before.
I think with the issue of surveillance, it seems a lot of people are willing to give that up or seemingly not even think it's really all that much of a problem. And you're here at this. This is the World Forum on Free Media, preceding the World Social Forum here in Montreal. There's not a whole lot of people here. I was thinking, like, the subject of free media should be a pretty major thing, I would think. I know we were both at a session where someone was saying that technology is the kind of key thing for the 21st century, and we don't treat it as such, maybe. There's not enough attention on it. So I was just wondering, in the context of you're here from very far away, so you obviously think this is important. So what are some other things that you think are important issues?
Actually, an important reason for me to be in a place like this is specifically because there are so many people in this meeting who think about those political economy aspects of communication in general.
Now, when you say political economy of communication, what does that mean?
It means, where does the money come from? Who owns the structures? Who builds the structures? Who decides what they are going to look like? Who benefits from them? So, but very closely linked to where is the money to make this possible materially? How does it flow? And who are the people who come up in between all the time and benefit? And I think people here think about this not just in a about one specific area. Like, I mean, the focus of my organization is very much on the internet, but I think we do recognize that actually you need to look at this in a broader context of communication in general. And I find it really inspiring to see the work here of the many organizations that actually already try to do that and think about media or community media really across the spectrum, and not just at the internet, but also looking at other forms of communication, how these need to intersect, what that means for other rights. I think it's important that the internet civil society community makes many more connections with this kind of community. I wanted to come back to what you said about like surveillance. Yeah. People don't really seem to care, so I don't agree at all. I actually think people do care, in the same way that I think young people care about their privacy. The only thing is that their big concern about privacy is not vis-a-vis the state. Their big concern about privacy is vis-a-vis their parents. But a lot of young people know very well how to hide content from their parents that they don't want their parents to see. I think about surveillance also. If you ask people in a room how many are on Facebook, a lot of people will say they are. And if you ask how many of you feel like you can fully trust Facebook, see how many people will raise their hand? Very, very few. I think the distrust of all these companies is growing considerably. And Snowden has really done us a favor, I think, with the revelations, where it just became much more clear how much governments, what kind of access to data they exactly have, and how far it really goes. And it has really created a sense of unease on the part of many people, and I think also a growing distrust between citizens and their governments all over the world. And that fallout has come to businesses as well, which is the reason why you see a company like Apple, they're trying to turn privacy into their business model. This would not have been possible 5 years ago, because 5 years ago there wasn't enough of a real concern on the part of so many people that you could actually make money out of privacy.
Well, that that's what I was going to say, is that because this whole thing about who's doing it. So now, because there's this citizen concern or people concern, then Apple's going to take care of it for us, right? Apple's going to capitalize on it and capitalize off of it. Where, and that's kind of where I was going with people don't seem to care. There's not a whole lot of, I mean, all these people are still on Facebook. They're not taking action. You know what I mean? So the people who are taking action, I mean, some people are.
I think it's really important to kind of understand the complexities of these platforms in people's lives. I have a deep dislike of Facebook. I think it takes a lot of very political decisions which harm activists in many different ways. The fact that it has a real name policy is a very good example and valid across the world. It harms vulnerable communities everywhere. It's a bad thing, and Facebook is trying to sell it to everybody in the name of keeping us safe and secure, and it doesn't. In India, for example, there's a lot of women, victims of domestic violence, activists who don't want to use their caste name because their caste, if they make that public, it makes them much more vulnerable. Facebook wants to ignore all of this and act as if it doesn't exist. Facebook is a horrible company, but I am on Facebook.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the reasons I'm on Facebook is I've lived in 4 countries in my life. I have friends in many different places. The network effect is real. Everybody seems to be on Facebook. If I leave Facebook, I also decide, or I give the signal that all of those connections are less worth to me than the harm that Facebook is doing in my life, which is really complicated because the harm Facebook does in my life in many ways remains abstract. The joys I get out of using Facebook are very direct with people I care about. So I don't think we should be really careful with not making the simplistic distinctions. I think this is the same for everybody. But so I criticize Facebook. I criticize Facebook on Facebook all the time. I'm very careful about what I post. I encourage people around me to do the same thing. We try and pull up Facebook at a policy level as well for the things that it does. So we've campaigned against the real name policy, for example. And then I hope that people will come up with alternatives. So the message that we are even on Facebook are spreading is it doesn't have to be like this. And there is enough people who have to be willing to say, yes, I don't want it to be like this. But at the moment, it's there, and it has a complex place in people's lives. It's not because they're on it. that they think Facebook is a great company, but all the people that they are using Facebook and that are their friends, especially people close to them, they think they are great. Then what do you do?
Well, that's what we were talking about today, is what do we do to try and make an alternative? And if there's no alternative, then there's all this energy about being concerned is not being used, and it's actually, if people are still just using Facebook, then it's still going into supporting Facebook.
Well, I think there are, when it specifically comes to activism, I think people do already do things like make sure content is posted in different places and in a place you can control as well, where it will not be taken down. That includes like secure servers if you're an activist, so that your material doesn't completely disappear. But obviously, the work of coming up with these alternatives has to continue. The problem is, of course, that with all of these, like, you will only know you have a winner once you hit upon it, right? Like, it's like we can have this conversation now and say, like, yeah, we need an alternative, but we don't know what it has to look like.
Yeah.
Because if we did, we wouldn't have be having this conversation, right? We'd be working on it. So the only thing you can do is kind of try little bits and pieces and try and push it and see what works. What strikes me here, though, as well, is a general kind of a slight sense of despondency, I guess, about where activism is at in general at the moment. More real, like people who organize, not things that come up spontaneously, but people who have organized over long periods of time, struggling to build connections in a world where increasingly global capital is back on the rise. And culturally, as people here have been pointing out, there is also more and more across the world a move to the right. That means there is a set of values that is dominant that's not really hospitable to the activists that are here and the work that they do. And I think that's maybe a question that's as important, not just like what is that platform we need to develop, but how do we win hearts and minds? To use a very cheesy capitalist commercial slogan, but I think it's true in a way, that how do you win people back to that language of like solidarity, justice, and I think a different humanity, where, you know, trying to respect people in their totality, including their difference. I think that might be a bigger battle. It's all, and as difficult to answer as like, how are we, like, what is the one solution to counter Facebook?
Yeah, it just makes me think, I was telling you about this book by Robert McChesney,
right,
called Digital Disconnect, and it's like you were saying, political economy of the internet, and what he was saying is one thing that's really emerged is that the internet, the way it is run, really tends to monopoly. Facebook being one of the monopolies, Apple being, iTunes being one of the monopolies, Google being one of the monopolies, Amazon being one of the monopolies. And I just, when you were saying there's this trend, like a long-term trend where we're you were saying to the right, people might be saying corporal fascism. Maybe does this, obviously the internet is related to this trend, but how does that all get together?
Well, what I think is interesting about the big internet companies, I don't think they're monopolies, but they do have enormous market hegemony. But there are, I don't use iTunes, for example, so I don't touch the Apple.
Yeah. Well, I was just talking about, he's saying like these are all like 90% share.
No, that's true. But I think what I find really interesting is how in almost every country you have competition policy that would not make it possible for a business to become that big in that country. What we are looking again at is actually very similar to debates we had about MNCs 20 years ago, but MNCs that worked on different issues, to kind of say, how do you counter this at the global level, right? Because the power they have...
You said MNC, that was multinational corporation.
Yes. And the power that a company like Facebook or like Google has globally is really unacceptable. And maybe they might use it sometimes in ways that we think are great, but that doesn't really matter.
The problem is they have that power in the first
place. Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Because the money that's behind them and the influence they have, and they're not accountable to anybody except their shareholders and, I mean, in, to that extent, to their users, because they have to keep their users happy enough to make sure there is enough profit to make their shareholders happy. But that's true with Facebook. I think the levels of dissatisfaction with Facebook, I think, are growing among large communities and quite strongly, but not enough to go beyond that threshold where it's actually hurting Facebook's bottom line. Facebook's advertising revenue in the first quarter of this year grew bigger than they had expected. So financially, they're doing very well, no matter how dissatisfied all of us might be.
Thank you.
You're welcome.